Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on WCTCAM or RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm well.
I would like to talk about that very popular topic, genetically modified seeds.
Okay.
Everyone loves that topic, right? We have to talk about it because the food supply is really more important than the oil supply. Because you can get by with very little oil. You cannot get by with very little food. I mean, they're both important. And I just had an interesting experience with a very high-ranking official in the Austrian government in the Ministry of Agriculture was over my house a couple of weeks ago. And we talked about genetically modified foods. And they are fighting tooth and nail in Europe to keep genetically modified foods out of Europe.
And there are people fighting tooth and nail to do the same here. They're just losing.
Well, we've lost already, right? And in Austria in particular, they really want to keep the food. But, you know, with the European Union, if it gets in, it gets in. So Austria is fighting very hard to keep genetically modified foods out. It's American and international corporations fighting to get in. And they're trying to use the presidency. They're trying to use the Pope. They're lobbying anywhere they can to break in. And, you know, the rosy picture we hear from people who make genetically modified materials is we need genetically modified materials to feed the world. Well, you know, I think if we had a broad-based agricultural system of a dispersed food supply, that's another model by which you could conceivably feed the world. But what more and more farms and fewer hands with fewer and fewer companies owning patents on seeds leads to is a few mega mondo farms in small numbers of places. It also leads to taking small farmers and getting them off their land, and so locally subsistence farmers don't exist. They can't. They can't compete. One of the things they promise with these genetically modified organisms, and it's illegal to test genetically modified organisms without the permission of the owners of the patent, is they say they'll never do any harm. They'll never do any harm. The butterflies are dying? They'll never do any harm. The bees are what?
The bees are.
I can't say that.
We're in a lot of trouble without the bees.
I can't say that genetically modified materials have any effect on that. But here are some of the rosy pictures. Some of the pictures not so rosy, and here are some of the problems. This is a story from the New York Times from this spring. A vast majority of soybeans and corn planted in this country and in much of the world are genetically engineered, and the technology is rapidly pushing its way into many more crops. For farmers, the benefits are real. With these seeds, they can spend less time plowing and cultivating and can use more benign agricultural chemicals to kill weeds. So what you do is you make a genetically modified crop that's resistant to one sort of weed killer. And then you can use that weed killer to kill all the weeds.
Kill everything else but it.
Right, so you spray it on that crop, it doesn't die. But according to a recent report from the National Research Council, there are some signs of trouble. Chief among them, the appearance of, in various parts of the country, ready for this? Herbicide-resistant weeds. Such weeds could undermine the main purpose.
Of course that was going to happen. I mean, plants, all of nature has a desire to procreate, has a desire to live. And we adapt. That's what happens in nature. If something comes along that's going to eradicate something else, the thing that was going to be eradicated comes up with an adaptation.
Such weeds could undermine the main purpose.
Darwin, I believe, was the guy.
He's the guy. We're trying to defeat him. Such weeds could undermine the main purpose of genetically engineered crops. Their ability to tolerate spraying with glyphosate is an environmentally benign herbicide marketed by Monsanto, is one of the main producers of genetically engineered seeds under the name Roundup. As ever, nature is finding its way around our defenses. Okay, so we genetically engineer things to be resistant to Roundup, and we put those things out in the environment. They're living organisms that procreate on their own, whether we like it or not. And then guess what? Some of the weeds are picking up resistance to Roundup. Now, you say all along there must have been some weeds that were resistant to glyphosate. Well, Here we have, there were no glyphosate-resistant weeds. That's right, I said zero glyphosate-resistant weeds when genetically engineered crops were introduced. A farmer could plant Monsanto's seeds, spray Roundup, kill the weeds, and enjoy the harvest. Now there are many such weeds, and they are tenacious. Some farmers using genetically engineered cotton are facing the prospect of more frequent plowing and the use of other herbicides. Wait a second. One of the promises was we wouldn't have to use
other herbicides.
So now you've got to pay Monsanto for the seed, you've got to pay Monsanto for the Roundup, and then you've got to buy other stuff anyway, and you haven't done a damn thing except get Monsanto in the I got to pay you loop.
And we keep bringing on, and this just happened in the last couple of weeks, we keep bringing on new crops and new genetically modified crops, and we put them into our farms and we put them into our lands. And if you're a listener of the show, you've heard us say it before. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. Once that's out in nature, it's out in nature, and you can't undo it.
You want to hear one of the something I heard from a farmer friend of ours just recently? Mm-hmm. He said, you know what one of the weeds is now? You know what one of the weeds that he deals with is now? And his farmer friends are finding is a real problem, and this has really not been reported. Corn. Corn is a weed because when the Roundup resistant corn, you know, the bees come and pollinate, right. And then the corn goes into your field. And if you're not growing corn,
right?
Corn is. Have you seen the size of a corn stalk?
Right.
It's pretty big weed.
Right. It's a pretty big weed.
It's pretty big.
Doesn't go so good with the cotton.
Doesn't go so good in the cotton fields or the soybean fields. Or in your backyard or in the woods or wherever the hell it grows, and you can't get rid of it. Isn't that crazy? Corn as a weed, and you can't kill it.
You can't kill it.
I'm sorry, genetically engineered stuff, it is not
the only
answer.
We're not careful enough. The bottom line is we are not careful enough. I don't believe in it because we as a society are not careful enough. And if we were more careful, maybe I would have more faith, but we're not careful enough, so I have zero faith.
Here's the deal. We as a society, we as individuals, whether you're Christian or you're an atheist, if you're an atheist, we know that as man we're imperfect, right? If you're Christian, you believe in the fallibility of man, right? We are, almost all religions teach that humans are fallible. We will make mistakes. And if the chances are one in a million that something could go wrong, but you put out a million of them, something's going to go wrong. And if you put out 100 million of them...
Here's the good news. If you believe we're fallible, the good news is we're failing. Yeah. So we're there.
And proof that we
have.
Anyway, genie, back in the bottle. I'll be very careful with genetically modified foods. I wish Europe all the best in keeping them out. And you should really educate yourself on this issue. We try to do it all the time. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. And our guest today is Nick Fauchold, returning to the show. Nick is editor-in-chief of TastingTable.com. He was food editor of Food & Wine magazine and Every Day with Rachel Ray magazine. And TastingTable.com is one of the most innovative online food resources that you'll find out there today.
Hey, Nick, how have you been?
I've been great. How have you been?
We're doing all right. And you know, it's funny, one of our main ways that we market and communicate with our guests for our restaurant and somewhat for our radio show, or for our restaurants, I should say, and somewhat for our radio shows, is we send an email every week. And it's a very personal email, and it's a different style. It's about us and our lives and the show. It really should be a blog and the restaurants. It should kind of be a blog. And I'm always grateful when people come in and they say, oh, I read your emails all the time. And I always say, thank you for not deleting me, you know, because we all have so much in our inboxes. And TastingTable.com sends me an email a couple of times a week, and I never delete it. Sometimes I don't read it right away. I save it, but I never delete it. What exactly is your business model, and why are your emails so interesting?
Well, our business model obviously centers around people like yourself opening those emails and reading them whenever possible. You know, you can sign up. We have now 7 editions in various cities across the country and a couple of national editions. And we're launching a spirits and cocktails only edition in March. So, you know, it's a big ask on our end for people to open their all of these emails every day. So, in order to get them to do that, we try to deliver, you know, the best quality advice that we can. And if you read us enough and you take us up on recommendations, hopefully you'll keep opening those emails because you see us as a valuable source.
How many subscribers do you have now?
Right now about 650,000.
That's a lot of subscribers. That's a lot of folk.
It is, yeah. It is, and we're growing quickly, so it's very exciting.
I think we should tell folks in our studio audience, if you want to subscribe to TastingTable.com, as long as you keep opening my emails, you may do so. The way it works is it's a small blurb, you know, usually it fits on a page when I open it on my monitor, of something interesting like a caviar producer or what did you have? You had a cajeta producer or some unusual food product or something really wild that is not paying to be on your site and not paying to be in your email. And obviously, there's a click-through usually where you can read more or link to some interesting food product or food producer, but what's in your little blurb there is not paid advertising. There's paid advertising on the side of your site, as there is on in most emails and most websites. But that's strictly editorial, right?
Correct. Yeah, we're not paid for play. Obviously, there are ads in our emails. Those are clearly marked, and that's how we pay the bills because Tasting Table is a free publication. So, you know, we have to keep the lights on somehow by selling ads.
What I like about it is everything's kind of depending. Every day for me is different. And some days I have lots of time, and some days I have no time at all. So I can choose, and I can take a look at that article, but there's and you know read your little two paragraphs and say, oh, that's what he's talking about today. But if it's something I'm really into or something I'm really interested in or something we might want to talk about on Restaurant Guys, I can then dive in a little deeper. There's always a click-through. There's always more information behind it.
Exactly. And Francis, to your point about, you know, saving emails and I have a lot of readers write in and say that they actually physically print the email and stick it in a folder, which kind of defeats the purpose of, electronic publication. But we knew this was something that a lot of people wanted to do. It's hard to remember everything, especially that you're, you know, flipping through in your inbox so quickly. So we added a feature called Tasting Table To-Dos. And at the bottom of every one of our stories, there's a button that says Add to My To-Do List. If you click on it, it will create a list for you, a personal list, that you can save all of our, you know, restaurant recommendations. If we recommended a bottle of wine you wanted to buy later, if we recommended a product you wanted to order, that will all be saved in one spot, or a recipe you wanted to cook. That has been a big game changer for us and our readership because this makes it much easier for them to remember where they read about something and remember, you know, where they want to go on their next night out.
When did you do that? When did you start doing that?
We did this in August. And just last month, beginning of the year, we launched a mobile version of it, an iPhone app called Tasting Table To Go. And so if you have a to-do list, it can then be sent on your iPhone. And you can actually stand on the corner of the street, say you're in New York City, and it will show a map of all of the things that you've marked on your to-do list around you. So you're standing in Soho one afternoon, you don't know what to do, you don't know where you should eat. This will show you exactly what you've saved. Or if you just want to see everything that Tasting Table's covered, it will map all of that out as well.
Can I tell you, I live in New Jersey, and my girlfriend lives in Manhattan, and even living in Jersey, I've always been back and forth to Manhattan quite a bit, you know, living in Jersey City. And I always find myself saying, oh, you know what, tonight, it's kind of a slow night in the restaurant, I'm not going into work, let's go out to dinner. And I think there are 400 restaurants I want to visit, but right now,
right,
that are on my list at home of places to go see, but right now I can't think of them.
Or worse, I just had 5 cocktails, and now I really can't remember.
But what's funny is I have used this on my phone and on my computer, which I can I have a Google document, where I have a folder for emails, not just from Tasting Table, and one is called Foods to Get, and the other is called Restaurants and Bars to Do. And Tasting Table accounts for 30% of the emails in that folder. I didn't know about the to-do function, and I think I'm gonna use
time
that.
Time to delete that folder.
Well, except that I have the old iPhone 3 because I'm waiting for the iPhone for Verizon to come out, and then I'm going to wait a little while longer until it works out all of its bugs. So I tried to download your app, damn you, Nick Fauchold, and you need the iPhone 4 in order for it to work.
Well, you can have an iPhone 3. You just have to have the latest software.
Yeah, but if you
have the upgrade.
But if you have an iPhone 3 and you put the iPhone 4 software on it, it actually begins to smoke.
Yeah, that's what I use. It was great.
Smoke comes out of it, and it starts to whir, and it sounds like a transmission. There are no moving parts. I don't know how it does that, but it's not very good. But the app sounds great, and you know, the idea of having it personalized of your to-do list of things that you check off, and then it finds you where you are and sends you there, I think it's really terrific stuff. You wrote an article recently about the phenomenon that's somewhat related to this of everyone's a food blogger. And we all know there's no reason to beat this dead horse again. Yes, you know, in a one-way media environment 15 years ago, there was the New York Times restaurant critic, there was the New York Magazine restaurant critic, and there were a few other restaurant critics. And then there was Zagat, and that was the big popular voice. Now everybody has a food blog, and there are a million different food bloggers, and even the big restaurant critics are blogging. But there are folks who, and look, some of them are regular customers, and I just don't understand it personally. People who take pictures.
I will tell you that we did a Paul Hobbs dinner recently, and while we were doing the dinner, my computer downstairs, which you know, gives me a clicker whenever somebody posts something about Stage Left or Kath Lombardi, was going off that people in the dinner were actively, sending pictures and posting.
And well, I think,
live blogging your meal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that's great, and the enthusiasm there is terrific, and you're there at a special event, and Paul Hobbs is there, and that was a huge dinner, and it was really remarkable. But there are folks who every meal is documented and put up on their blogs. I know several people like this. Like, they take a picture of every breakfast, every dinner, and a lot of people that I respect and have great taste in food. But you wrote an article about this recently, and is that food porn? Is that what is that? How does the constantly recording and sharing everything you eat, where does that fit into our social networking lexicon of today?
Well, working on the story, I learned a lot. This was in Food and Wine magazine in the January issue. And the story actually was their idea. They asked me to sort of become one of these folks who tracks everything they eat, whether it's blogging via Twitter. There's other apps for your iPhone. A popular one is called Food Spotting, but lets you take a picture and it tags it based on the location of the picture, and other people can see photos of food and little write-ups nearby at nearby restaurants. So they had me kind of experiment with all of these things. And, you know, for me, keeping track of what I eat has always been a very personal and or professional thing. And it's always been, you know, writing notes in a notebook and keeping it to myself. And then if I decide to write about something, obviously that becomes public knowledge. But, you know, not every morsel I put in my mouth has ever been something I thought the world should hear about. So they asked me to do this primarily via Twitter. So I had a Twitter feed. Anything I ate, I tweeted for about a month. And then I also experimented with food spotting and a few other kind of streams of information.
And so what did you find out?
I found out it's a lot of work, first of all. You know, you forget that I had three gummy bears. I need to go back and send that out. I didn't advertise the fact that I was doing this to friends or family or coworkers. So I had no one really following me, so I didn't feel too embarrassed about anything I was eating. You know, I had, during that month, I was in Texas for a weekend and probably had about 2 weeks worth of food in that weekend. And going back and looking at that later on, it was very embarrassing to see, you know, visiting 12 food trucks in one day. If anyone else had been reading that, they probably would have thought I had a problem.
Okay, just one quick second, Nick. I know you pretty well.
Yeah.
You have a small problem.
Well, no, that's why I think half the reason that we're all in this business is so that we have the excuse to eat whatever we want, whenever we want. We're like, research. It's all about research.
Exactly.
You know, though, I think it's – I take pictures of food occasionally. If I'm out at a restaurant – we were at Alinea in Chicago recently, and there were some dishes that were brought out, and I was like, that is a really interesting plate presentation. And I want to remember it, not to copy it in my restaurant, but to share that with, and you know what, primarily who I want to share it with? For me, it's my chef. and Mark, and I want to talk about how that informs what we do.
But you were actually sharing it with me, so you didn't have to take a picture of it.
Right, but I wanted to remember it because we were also having wine, and I wanted to bring it back to the chef and talk about it. But I see people take pictures of their food all the time, and it's just something that I think it's great, and I think I'm very complimented when it's my food,
exactly.
and they feel that they want to preserve that memory. I don't understand it myself. I was always a guy who never took pictures. I just don't do that.
And I am too. And a lot of times I feel like it's an intrusion in the restaurant. It's distracting to the staff and the other diners. I've been at meals where someone sitting at the table next to me will hand their plate to a waiter and say, "Do you mind, holding this up? I want to get better light while I shoot it."
All right, that's too much. You're over the top.
Yeah, there's a line. But I also learned the takeaway from looking on the story is that you do remember food better.
Yep.
It's like when you teach somebody something, you remember it better yourself. When you take a picture and share it, you tend to remember that dish.
Yep.
Better yourself. And as someone, I'm kind of a food amnesiac. I don't remember anything I've eaten unless I've written it down and told someone about it. So if I keep it to myself, I probably will forget about it. And taking pictures of my food and writing down what I've eaten and sending it out into the ether actually helped me remember all of those meals I had in that month much more vividly than any other time in my life.
That's one of the reasons also that I do it especially if I'm traveling abroad and not going to see Mark or the chef for a while. I take pictures of the things that I find that are striking, and it there is a little bit of nostalgia there. I get it, but I still am a food eater, not a food photographer. But hey, listen, we need to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment talking with Nick Fauchold of TastingTable.com. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. You know, restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass, but I often find that a great glass of wine I order in a restaurant comes to me flat or even spoiled. It's been my experience as a restaurateur that wine preservation systems just don't work, until now. Now, Mark and I have searched for 20 years, and we finally found a wine preservation system that does work. Vinfinity system for restaurants and bars. Vinfinity keeps bottles of wine tasting fresh for weeks. It's got 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. It never needs gas, it takes up very little room, it's easy to install, easy to use, and virtually maintenance-free. And the bottles don't need to stay attached to the machine, so one Vinfinity can preserve an infinite number of wines. We now offer dozens of wines by the glass at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, and because of Vinfinity, we know that every glass is right when it comes to you. Tell your favorite restaurant about the Vinfinity system. If you own a restaurant or bar, buy it. Go to VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953 and tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're with Nick Fauchold of TastingTable.com, who has his finger on the pulse of food throughout the nation. Actually, that's my next question. Nick, do you have your finger on the pulse of food throughout the nation?
Absolutely. And it's beating very quickly these days.
How do you – I mean, you cover restaurants, you cover bars, you cover cocktails, and you cover food products that people can buy at home. You have a staff of writers, and you're the editor-in-chief. Where do the stories come from?
Most of them come from our own hands, our own editors. We have editors in every city where we have an edition, so L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, D.C., New York, and so on. And then we also have a staff of – we have a network of freelance writers around the country. So anywhere we don't have editors, we have a stringer or a few freelance writers who will contribute stories and ideas regularly.
And a difference with TastingTable.com, and I think this really speaks to the quality of the blog over time, is you got the – would you call this a network, a blog, a newsletter? What are you?
Email publication, digital publication.
It's really a
new, definitely not a blog, and I wouldn't consider it a newsletter either.
It's a new paradigm, isn't it? I mean, are other folks I find Tasting Table to be doing quite what Tasting Table is doing.
I hope so. I mean, what we wanted to do when we launched 2 years ago, our goal was to try and deliver only recommendations of things that we've tried and vetted and approved ourselves. A lot of what you get, I think, in your inbox and what you read online and elsewhere isn't really first-hand recommendations. It's second or third-hand or speculation. Yeah. So we try to really keep it simple and only tell our readers about things that we've tried and loved pickups.
I think, well, a lot of these sites that have interesting tips on food are aggregator sites. And you're sufficiently capitalized to have a staff. How many on your staff?
Our staff right now is about 25.
That's a lot for you know, getting a little email in my box every day, but it really speaks to the quality. Let's talk about something that is sort of current in the last couple of years, and you sent out an email entitled Hidden Agenda, Gain Access to a Secret Dining Club. Let's talk about pop-up dining and secret dining clubs.
Absolutely. You know, I have mixed feelings about these, and there's a new one. I wouldn't call it a pop-up restaurant. Because the chef adamantly refuses to use that word. But there's a new restaurant called What Happens When in New York, and it just opened a couple weeks ago. The chef is John Fraser, who has a very great restaurant on the Upper West Side called Dovetail. So what he did is trying to shift the pop-up paradigm a little bit. So he opened a space. He leased a space for a year, 9 months or a year, and every month the look and feel and the menu of the restaurant will change kind of thematically. Right now it's focusing on Scandinavian food, and it's, you know, it easily could have slipped into kind of the world of gimmick or style over substance. But the food there is so excellent that, you know, you can kind of let go and enjoy the whole experience, and it's a very different kind of pop-up restaurant from what I've seen.
So is the appeal of the pop-up restaurant that if I don't go, I'm going to miss it? Is that kind of, do you think that's what's drawing people to these restaurants?
Technically, yeah. It's, you know, it's the same thing that makes flash sales and sample sales so appealing. You give people a sense of urgency. Here's your one chance to try this. If you miss it, then you're going to feel left out. In some cases, that's true. Some pop-up restaurants are amazing, and they go away and they never return. You know, this happens a lot on the West Coast. Chef Ludovic Lefebvre has done a thing called Ludo Bites in L.A. and written about everywhere, and the demand for his dinners is insane. And he moves locations every time, so, and it's only open for a few weeks. That, again, though, is an example of a pop-up restaurant with top-notch food versus a lot of these where it's a chef cooking somewhere at, you know, someone else's restaurant for a night, and, you know, they just don't take the time to kind of get everything together and get the quality to, you know, the right level where it's really worth your time to fight for a ticket.
As a restaurant owner, I look at some of these pop-up restaurants where somebody's going to basically build a restaurant for 4 or 6 weeks or 3 weeks, and that's so daunting to me. I mean, building a restaurant and coming up with the ideas for a restaurant and staffing it and putting all the materials into it, it is a huge project. How does it get accomplished for a 4 week or a 6 week restaurant?
Well, that's the problem. A lot of times it doesn't, because it takes, you know, months, if not longer, sometimes to find your feet at a new restaurant and to get everything right. So you have to take some of these restaurants with a grain of salt and think of it as performance art. Sometimes it can be a lot of fun, though, because it does feel so casual and freewheeling. Zach Palacio had a restaurant on Bleecker Street here in New York called Cabrito. He shut it down, and with the plan of opening a finer dining restaurant in the same space. In the meantime, he opened a pop-up or temporary restaurant, whatever you want to call it, called Fatty Johnson's. And the menu is changing frequently based on dishes that he has served at his other restaurants in the past. So kind of like the greatest hits album of Fatty Crab and so on. But the interesting thing to me there is that every night there's a different bartender, different guest bartender. And so they can bring their own cocktail repertoire with them. Dave Wondrich, who you just had on your show, was, I believe, the bartender the first night of this. So it's very interesting to see these guys kind of, it's almost like a music venue where, you know, they play one night and then they move on.
You know, I think pop-up restaurants, and so, pardon me, and something else I want to ask you about, which are secret dining societies. You know, they appeal to a similar aesthetic to that, you know, the speakeasy with the hidden door downtown that you don't know where it is and you need the secret phone number to get into, or the secret phone number that you can text to get into because now they don't even answer the phone. I think there's a certain appeal there. What's your feeling on the secret restaurant, on the secret – and, you know, often these restaurants are actually legitimately illegal because they'll be held in someone's apartment or some warehouse somewhere, and, you know, they're not – they don't have a food license there, and they'll be there for a weekend and gone. And then this society will meet somewhere else, and there's this whole cloak and dagger, like, you get a text 48 hours before the next dinner or 72 hours before the next dinner where it's going to be, and it's a yes or no, and if you're no too many times, you're out of the club. What's the appeal of that?
Well, the appeal is, you know, exclusivity and being part of something that no one else can experience.
Mm-hmm.
Tricky thing is, you know, it's as a business owner, you can't make money by having something super exclusive. So a lot of these so-called speakeasies and secret restaurants, or whatever you want to call them, aren't really that much of a secret. They have publicists and they have reservationists, and they're actually not that secret at all. There still is that element, though, of you know, underground dining clubs, but it's not as prevalent as you would think.
So what you're saying is, if you have a publicist, you're not really a secret restaurant.
Exactly.
You know, but I think, you know, I've always thought about the sort of the whole prohibition aesthetic, which I call the prohibition prohibition aesthetic. And I understand the appeal of a speakeasy and the appeal of wanting to do something exclusive and different, because I think that stuff is so immediately available. I remember when I'm 45, right? So when I was 22 and first, like, looking for cool restaurants and cool bars in Manhattan, I mean, Merc Bar opened or Enye opened downtown, and nobody knew about it for 6 months. And then you might see it in the Village Voice, and then a couple of months or so later, you might see it in New York Magazine. And then, you know, what we would say is, you know, then the Suits would arrive. And when the Suits got there, you were on to the next place. And you could stay 6 months ahead of everybody else. And it's not possible to really do that anymore, I don't think. Is it?
No, that cycle takes about a week now.
Yeah. And the week is the 2 weeks before the restaurant opens. So, you know, by the time it opens, you know, it's almost passé, you know.
But even when we opened we opened our first restaurant 18 years ago. We opened our second restaurant 5 years ago. The difference in what happened and how people knew about it was remarkable. We opened our first restaurant 18 years ago. First reviewer came maybe 3 months into the restaurant. The more mainstream reviewers started coming 5 months, 6 months, eight
right.
months, a year later. And we opened this new restaurant. We had reviewers in our restaurant 2 weeks into the restaurant.
We literally opened the doors quietly and did everything but not turn the lights on because we wanted a really soft opening.
And by the way, no publicist.
Right,
so we really did try and do it that way.
But, you know, one guy with a viral email, and everybody knows. There's no way that any – you know, the only way to be exclusive is to be Velvet Rope or to have this illusion of exclusivity. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, we now have a pretty broad readership, so we try to cover things that everyone can enjoy, which is why you don't see us writing about many supper clubs or underground bars or anything like that, because if our readers actually can't go and experience it for themselves, there's no point for us to pat ourselves on the back for having access that they don't have.
Well, I also think that one of the things that I really enjoy is, as a consumer, we think that as restaurateurs, we need to support our chef in many ways, and we collaborate on the food a lot. We talk about the food a lot, but one of our jobs is to source great ingredients for our chef, because he's in the kitchen cooking and we can be in the office and source great ingredients. I'll be honest with you, Nick. I found a couple of things that I use behind the bar professionally, and I'm pretty good. I think I pretty much know about stuff before it's coming in. But there's some bitters that I found through your site that I then contacted the folks and I buy wholesale now and bring in professionally. And that's quite a compliment because, you know, you surprise me sometimes with the stuff that you can get. And this is stuff you can often – you give the website of the place where you can get it or the phone number of the place where you can get it. And that's pretty amazing to me.
We'll wait for our new edition to come out in March. It's going to be called Tasting Table Top Shelf, and it's going to be all bleeding-edge cocktail mixology trends and products. So that will be kind of just right for you guys.
Actually, I look at it sometimes. It's much worse for me. Occasionally, I will look in there, and there'll be some hot, new, cool ingredient, secret weapon that I have, and then it'll be in Tasting
and
Table.
And you've blown it. We've
and
had it for a
month.
It's
not secret anymore.
You've blown it on us. Well, Nick, we won't hold that against you, and we want to thank you for coming on the show again today.
Thanks for having me. It's fun.
If you go to tastingtable.com, you can subscribe to various newsletters. We do, and you should as well. You can find out more about Nick Fauchel, tastingtable.com, and the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to us on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. You know, talking with Nick Fauchel, I remember... I'm thinking back. It's 1987. I'm wearing a skinny leather tie, gray Capizios, and I have a collar bar.
I'm sure you're in a members-only jacket, too.
I was just past the members-only
thing.
I was also past the parachute pants, right? I was a little more sophisticated than that. But I think I had a collar bar, and the collar bar...
You making fun of my members-only jacket? Is that what you're doing now?
Did you have one?
I had one in 83 or 81, whatever high school years are.
Here's a fashion statement for you. Back then they had collar bars. I don't know if you remember
this. Oh, I remember collar bars very
well. Collar bar.
I came from Nutley. Collar bar is a very Nutley kind of thing. Okay, they're probably still wearing collar bars in Nutley, okay?
I don't think so. I think even they have gone beyond collar bars. But collar bars were, you had this tiny skinny tie with this little knot. And what you do is a collar bar clipped onto each side of your collar went under the knot. It was a metal bar, and it sort of held up the knot so your tie stuck out a little bit. And then, to take it a little bit step further, this was so New Jersey, I can't believe it. They had shirts that had holes in the collar, and you could put a collar bar
for the collar bar
through a screw-in collar bar.
I never had a...
Hold on to your hats. It gets a little bit better. And... Some of these collar bars, and they would sell the collar bar with the shirt, so you know it wasn't exactly a beautiful piece of jewelry, right? Came with the shirt. It wasn't gold. It was
kind of like a plastic collar stack.
It was goldish, is what it was. It was metal, and it was painted gold, but it was not gold. And some of them would have, and this only worked on the ones that had the holes through, because you screwed the collar bar on each side. I know some of you can't even picture this, right? But if you weren't born, and lucky you. And they would also have a chain around on each side of the collar bar, so a little gold chain went around
your knot. Would
hang knot.
Around the knot of the tie.
Do you remember that?
I never had one, but I do remember.
So you had your gold chain around your neck, chain on your wrist, and your tie had a necklace. I mean,
realize that if you had to wear a tie,
yeah.
You didn't get to show off
your gold chain,
your jewelry. You know, no, we could see your cross.
Oh my God! So. Or your St. Christopher medal, right? So I am thinking of myself, and it was probably just past that because after that, like vintage clothing became cool, and we went to just the opposite. If you were cool, or maybe I just got cooler. I don't know, but. Ocean Pacific shirts.
Can I help you with something that's going to make you feel a little bit bad for me just a second?
Yeah.
Ocean Pacific did not make clothes in my size.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Ocean Pacific
was... So I had an Ocean Pacific wallet.
It was the Miami Vice aesthetic of the late 80s or the mid to late 80s. But then I went to like sort of the pre-grunge vintage clothing fashion of 1988, 91.
I avoided that era.
But there were some really cool things going on in Manhattan, from bars to music venues to small restaurants. And this was the awakening of a real restaurant sensibility in Manhattan that was more akin to what we see today. But what you had was, as I talked about, you would find, if you were cool and lived downtown and you knew people, it was about what bartenders you knew. Mm-hmm. Did you know other people in the scene? Some hipster opens a restaurant that's actually sometimes good. There were two kinds. There were restaurants where models go to not eat food, you know, and that wasn't awesome.
They still have those.
Yeah. And then there were the, like, downtown cool, you know, East Village, when the East Village was a little bit edgy restaurants. And it was great. And you got to go there with kind of young people who were not mainstream for 2 months.
And people like Mario Batali were cooking at Poe and
David
and Barbara. Sure, this is, you're talking about the early 90s, late 80s.
Yeah, he was 92, 93. He was at Lucky Strike.
Right, he was at Lucky Strike, and people like David and Barbara, David Page and Barbara Shin
were
at Home in 93. You know, there were these restaurants
were
just that. They were these little kind of hole-in-the-wall places that were neighborhood, or if you were in the know, You learned about these restaurants early on.
And there were sort of drinking holes that were not necessarily dance clubs. And I had an apartment in the East Village at the time. And it felt really cool to be, like, part of this scene. And then time would go by, you'd get mentioned in New York Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then the Wall Street guys would come and find it because it was cool because all the hipsters were there. And then all the hipsters would leave and it would be left with the Wall Street guys. And then the Wall Street guys who were looking for the hipster girls would figure out that they were all alone and be looking for the next place. And then the Wall Street guys would leave. And then the people from the Upper West Side and the Bridge and Tunnel people from New Jersey would come in. And there was this chase. Everyone was chasing the hipsters all around Manhattan. Not that I was a hipster, but I was in the know and I would follow on to the hipsters.
You were chasing.
I was. The girls. Totally chasing the girls. And it was okay, too. I did all right. Anyway, so and I love good food and cocktails, and I just love that whole scene. And then there was a magazine, and I'll tell you, the magazine that really changed that and shortened that time to a couple of weeks was Time Out New York.
I knew that's the magazine you were talking about.
And this is before online. Time Out New York shortened that time. You know, the hipsters go there for a couple of weeks. It gets written about 3 weeks after it opens, and it's already not cool anymore. Mm-hmm. And then you had the internet. But, you know, there's a little magazine. It was Malcolm Forbes' last project before he died, the elder Malcolm Forbes' last project before he died. And it came out about 2 years before Time Out, or maybe it was more. It's all morphing together for me. And it was called Egg Magazine.
Mm-hmm, I remember.
Do you remember Egg?
I do.
That was so little known, it lasted about 14 months.
Yeah.
It was the coolest magazine, and I have every issue of Egg Magazine at home. And it was this odd format, and it was Time Out before there was Time Out.
You know what that makes
you? And a little more literary. An egghead? Yeah. You had to go for the low-hanging fruit, you know? You had to go for the low-hanging fruit. Egg Magazine was, boy, there's a little walk down memory lane. From Egg Magazine to TastingTable.com, we've come really far. And a lot of it's good, but I sort of miss the Egg Magazine days a little bit, to be honest with you. I hope you guys have enjoyed this hour with the Restaurant Guys as much as we have. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.